The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Use it all the time, and it's just, I advise you to get one. It's really worthwhile. I've had mine, I paid $9.30 for mine. and of course I bought it in, 1972 or so, It's a very handy thing to have, believe me. But anyway, if you check in there under the feeding of the 5,000, that's in all four Gospels. And the strange thing is, if you try to figure out, well, is somebody using somebody else? And you go through with a red pen and or different colored pens. Surely I have that in here. Wait a minute. Yes, here it is. Oh, no, well. You probably can't see this very well. But I went through and underlined in red material that's in Matthew and Mark. I underlined in yellow stuff that's common in Matthew and Luke. And I underlined in blue stuff that's in all three Gospels. And I underlined in green material that's in Mark and in Luke. And then I also, John has some parallels, and so anything that's in John and one of the other Gospels, I use the appropriate color there to indicate the correspondence. Blue, as I said, is in all three, and you'll notice that there's some material, I guess you can't see it, but there's some material that is in all three Gospels and verbally exact. But there's a lot of stuff that's in Matthew and Luke and not in Mark. There's a lot of stuff that's in Matthew and Mark and not in Luke. And there's a little bit of stuff that's in Mark and Luke but not in Matthew. And if you try to figure out, well, did Matthew use Mark? Well, there's lots of contrary information. And likewise, did Mark use Matthew? There's lots of contrary information. So just explaining the complexity of this, of these variations is virtually impossible on a very simple viewpoint, which means that no matter which, any of those viewpoints that I put up here earlier, Markan priority, Matthean priority, complicated oral source theories, whatever, has to do something complicated here. They have to say, for example, the two source theory says, well, the difficulty here is that it was in Mark and in Q. The story was in Mark and in Q. And so Matthew used some material from Q, but mostly Mark. And Luke used some material in Mark and Q, which explains the correspondences with Matthew. But of course, then you've got one of those theories that's formulated in such a way that even if it's not true, you couldn't possibly disprove it, because it's so complex that anything can be proven. Anything can be true. So basically, the feeding of the 5,000 makes it very complicated for any viewpoint. I'm going to get to my own viewpoint of what's going on here, but let's hold off on that for a bit. I started out by talking about what's against the two-source theory, and I want to continue that. Sorry about the sidetrack there. I mentioned the evidence of collation. There's also evidence that Mark is a later tradition. For example, the tradition on divorce. The material on divorce, which we find in Matthew in chapter 5, 32, and 19, 9 and following, appears to reflect something closer to an original Palestinian Jewish kind of thinking than we have in Mark. Now, I'm not speaking only of the exception clause, although that's part of it. You know that Matthew adds the words, except for porneia, whatever that is, and whoever divorces his wife except for porneia and marries another commits adultery, or forces her to commit adultery. That reflects a very Jewish kind of Palestinian way of thinking. Mark, on the other hand, not only does not have the except clause, but also says, or if a woman divorce her husband. Now, in Palestine, that legally was not possible. Now, there were ways for a woman to get away from her husband, but they involved some kind of fiction whereby pressure was brought to bear upon the husband to divorce his wife. But the wife did not have any actual legal recourse, any way to get divorced from her husband. As such, she had to employ some kind of complicated legal fictions, which meant that most women couldn't do it because that was expensive. But Mark, with his addition about a woman divorcing her husband, reflects more of a Roman situation, because in Rome, women could divorce their husbands and did so quite a bit. So that seems to suggest a later stage for Mark. Mark appears to be the later one there. Another example of lateness, apparent lateness in Mark, is Latinisms. There's a few places where Mark will have a Latin term that is not found in either Matthew or Luke. And I know I should have an example for you, and I didn't write one down, so I don't. But there are a few of these Latinisms or iticisms that are in Mark, which again reflect a later stage. Another problem for the two-source theory, or the Markan priority, is simply the problematic nature of Q. I mentioned that already. Q basically comes out being whatever you want it to be, and means that it doesn't really have any probative value hypothesizing a Q, and therefore it isn't really a value as a theory. Furthermore, most people, when they talk about Q, talk about it as a teaching source or a saying source. The difficulty is that the material, well, let's put it this way. Q is usually defined as the document which was the source for the material that is common to Matthew and Luke, but is not found in Mark. That's what Q is. The document that was the source for the material that is common to Matthew and Luke and not found in Mark. So the only thing that we really could construct of Q, even if it existed, the only way we could reconstruct it is by taking all the stuff that's in both Matthew and Q and not found in Mark and sticking it together. That's the material that's in Q. The difficulty is that when we examine that and then ask, what is this document Q? If all it is a listing of the material that's found in Matthew and Luke, it doesn't have too much coherence. It used to be thought, used to be argued, and I guess it still is, that it was a teaching source or a saying source. The difficulty is there's material what would be common to Matthew and Luke. There's material which is not strictly sayings material. Furthermore, you have material in Mark which corresponds to all of the things that have been suggested of Q. So if Q is a teaching material, for example, well, you have plenty of teaching material in Mark. If Q is regarded as narrative, you have plenty, lots and lots of narrative material in Mark. And if Q is regarded as a source of miracles, well, again, you have material in Mark that corresponds to that. Scholars who believe in Q are so divided on what Q is and what it contained that virtually there is no, there's not enough consensus that you could make any really firm decisions about Q. Now, I say that with a little hesitation, because there is a fairly significant number of scholars who are working together on what is called the Q Project. In the Society of Biblical Literature, there is a group of people that every year when the Society meets, they have several sessions together where they are working their way slowly through Matthew and Luke and trying to identify what material was in Q and what its original form was. Most of the time, they go with Luke. They tend to figure that Luke has something closer to the original form of what was in Q, and they're trying to come up with some kind of coherent document. But it's entirely, every stage of it is hypothetical, is hypothesis upon hypothesis upon hypothesis. And at no stage do you have any really firm ground. And so all this effort, with the goal ultimately of producing something like, I mentioned it earlier, this original gospel, which presumably had the ethical teachings of Jesus in it, enables these scholars to get back to an original great moral teacher. And that's, of course, what they want. They don't want a Jesus who's an apocalyptic prophet that's talking about himself all the time. They want a moral teacher, and so they think that this project can get them back to it. Anyway, the fact that the early church makes no reference to any sayings, document that existed or circulated independently in the church, the fact that there isn't one scrap of documentary evidence of such a thing, and you would think that if Q actually was a document containing the words of Jesus and that it circulated widely enough that both Matthew and Luke would have had access to it, you would have thought that the early church would have preserved it. And so it's very strange that Q doesn't exist now, if it ever did exist. So that's a problem for the two-source theory. And then finally, with regard to Luke, there's an interesting feature in Luke's use of Mark. Now, I have to point out here that almost everybody now thinks that all the different theories, except for the Griesbach hypothesis, almost all of the different theories, even the combination theories and the oral theories, accept that Luke probably used Mark or some form of Mark. But even that is problematic in that there is something called the Great Omission. This is not the Great Commission, but the Great Omission, which is simply Mark 5 to 8. That's roughly Mark 5 to 8. The material found in Mark chapter 5 to 8, to early part of 8, not all the way through, to maybe 8, the 20 so or so, or something. The material found in Mark 5 to about halfway through chapter 8 is simply entirely missing in the Gospel of Luke. So you have to suppose that either Luke had some earlier form of the Gospel of Mark, which didn't contain 5 to 8, or that Luke's copy was defective, or that that Luke, for some strange reason, skipped over those chapters in Mark. It's really difficult to make sense of it. None of them are terribly convincing, but there you go. That's the Great Omission, which is a problem for any of the source theories, basically. Now, that was against the two-source theory, some of the difficulties with the two-source theory. I have some specifics as well. I didn't mention, maybe I should have, but I didn't mention the fact that There's also a consideration explaining why certain changes would be made. If you compare Matthew and Mark, many times you can see that if Matthew is using Mark, then Matthew has smoothed Mark's reading. Mark may have something quite rough, sometimes a little bit awkward, and Matthew will use a little bit of smoothing. For example, I gave the example already where Mark may have parataxis, which is simply adding finite verbs together, indicative verbs connected with and. And Matthew will sometimes use participial constructions, which is a little bit smoother. On the other hand, you can find examples where the reverse is true. So although most of the time it looks like Matthew is improving Mark, occasionally it looks like Mark is improving Matthew. I'll give you one example of that, just so you have it in your quiver. In the Olivet Discourse, Mark, when he speaks of the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not, uses a neuter pronoun. Sorry, got that backwards. Mark uses a masculine pronoun. Matthew uses a neuter. Oh, wait a minute. I'm just proving the opposite of what I want to prove. So, so scratch that. That's okay. I'll have to come up with another example for you sometime. Let's go back to contra Griesbach, contra the other major dominant viewpoint, Matthew and Luke were used by Mark. With regard to Griesbach, there's a problem of strange development. Many places, Matthew and Luke seem to demonstrate theological development going beyond Mark. It seems unlikely that Mark would have modified Christology downwards. Now, a classic example of this is Matthew, the young man says, "Teacher, what good must I do to be saved?" And then Jesus says, "Why do you ask me about what is good?" In Mark, the young man comes up and says, "Good teacher, what must I do to be saved?" And Jesus says, "Why do you call me good? One is good," meaning probably God the Father is good. Now, that seems to suggest, or it could be read as suggesting, that Jesus is saying, "I'm not good." And so you can understand why, perhaps, Matthew would have modified it so that there was no indication of that. That's a possibility. But in any case, you can see it seems unlikely that if Mark were looking at Matthew, that he would change it to, "Why do you call me good?" On the other hand, if Matthew is using Mark, you can very well understand why Matthew might modify it to say, "Why do you ask me about what is good?" That seems to make more sense from a rationalistic point of view. So there seems to be a problem in that development. Another example is Matthew and Luke directly connect the cleansing of the temple with the triumphal entry. It happens right together, and you can easily see the connection. Mark delineates on the following day. Now, Mark seems therefore to make some kind of break in what is a very clear connection in Matthew and Luke. So if Mark is using Matthew and Luke, why did he make that change, which kind of takes away from the clear theological connections? Another example is, why is why are the prophecies of the Olivet Discourse in Mark 13, why are they more obscure and less comprehensible than what we have in Matthew 24 or Luke 21? And then we might also ask, why does some material in Luke seem to be not a development, a further development from Matthew, but actually reflect a tradition earlier than Matthew? For example, the Lord's Prayer in Luke 11, 1-4 seems to be a more primitive form than we have in Matthew 6. So that's a difficulty for the Griesbach hypothesis as well. There's also the problem of strange order. Why did Luke shift so much of the order of Matthew? There's the problem of strange omissions. Why does Mark omit the Sermon on the Mount, for example? And most especially, why did Mark omit all of the resurrection appearances? You would think that that would be a very great interest. And yet Mark has no resurrection appearances. Well, let me pause there. That's assuming the shorter ending of Mark. Most scholars now would hold that Mark ends at verse 8 of chapter 16. That used to be doubted because the way verse 8 ends is, "For they were afraid. The women went away, for they were afraid." And it actually ends in the Greek word gar. The post-positive gar, you remember that? And the last word of the gospel is gar, of verse 8. And so a lot of people felt that Mark had to have something more than that. And you can't imagine that Mark would stop without a resurrection appearance. And so there was an expectation that the later verses of Mark were genuine. However, both manuscript evidence and the internal evidence of comparing the material of Mark 16:9 and following to other material in Mark suggests that that was not original. And so it ends with verse 8, and then there's no record of the resurrection appearances. Even if verses 9 to 20 is legitimate in Mark 16, it still doesn't correspond to what's in Matthew and Luke. So again, you have that strange omission if Mark is using Matthew and Luke. And now I'll just mention one more, the problem of strange selectivity. It is odd that Mark would follow Matthew if nothing in Luke corresponds to Matthew, and follow Luke if nothing in Matthew corresponds to it, but refuse to follow either Matthew or Luke if both have the material but in different places, which is what would be the case if Mark is using Matthew. That was a little bit complicated, I know, but think of it a moment. If Mark is using Matthew and Luke, then what is happening is that if something is only in Matthew, then Mark can use it. Or if it's only in Luke, then Mark can use it. But if it's in both Matthew and Luke, but in different places, Mark will not use either one. And that seems strange. You would think that he'd just pick one or the other. Especially since if it's in both passages, that seems to be a stronger witness. So that's a strangeness for the Griesbach. Now, when we come back in 5 minutes, we'll talk about some things that are difficulties for both views, for any of the literary dependence views, and then get to my own. I think that I showed you the feeding of the 5,000. I think that passage works so thoroughly against both views that that it really ought to be talked about more often. And in fact, E.E. Ellis, who does hold to Mark and priority, nevertheless points out that the mixed order and disorder of the Q material in Matthew as opposed to Luke speaks not only against Luke's use of Matthew, but also against the unity of Q. So not only is there a difficulty with the Griesbach hypothesis, but also with the Holtzman theory, because of the strange nature of the order of Q. A second problem for both views is the fact that in all of the Gospels, there's occasionally this grammatical structure, which is uses the Greek word egeneto. It came to pass. Plus an indicative verb. Now, actually, egeneto can also occur with infinitives, and that actually happens more frequently. But this strange, which is really a grammatical solecism, so far as Greek goes. Solecism meaning a grammatical error. Okay, but egeneto with an indicative verb. You're having an indicative, you have two indicative verbs joined together. And that's a very awkward and strange grammatical formulation in Greek. However, if you back translate it into a Semitic language like Aramaic or Hebrew, it's a very common construction. And you might remember from Hebrew, vayehi, okay, plus either an infinitive or a finite verb. And so that construction seems to suggest an earlier stage of the tradition, doesn't it? It suggests that this is taken from some originally oral Aramaic or perhaps Hebrew, but more likely Aramaic source. So egeneto with the verb reflects a Semitic tradition. But the strange thing is that it is found in different places in all the Gospels, and sometimes uniquely. In other words, there are places in Mark which have that construction that is not found in Matthew or Luke, and there's places in Matthew that it's not found in the other Gospels. I'll mention here two of them. One, Mark 1:9, it's found in Mark and not any other Gospel. Mark 4:4, Luke 5:1, and actually many places in Luke, but I'll just mention Luke 5:1 as one example. Matthew 7:28 and 11:1, actually 13:53, 19:1, and 26:1, the closings of all of the major sermons of Matthew have that construction. And the odd thing is that it is most frequent in Luke alone. Now, the reason I say it's strangest is because Luke is supposed by most to be the latest gospel on the mark and priority theory. And even if it's not the, even if you hold to the Griesbach theory, Luke is still later than Matthew. And so it's strange that Luke here, which is supposedly a most Hellenistic gospel, the most Greek, Grecized gospel, is yet the one that has this Semitic construction most frequently. That seems to work against virtually every viewpoint. Where did this come from? You can't imagine Luke, who writes very elegant Greek in the book of Acts, simply making these up. Why would he do that? If his sources did not have them, if either Mark or Matthew did not have them, then why in the world would he make them up? Because they're not good Greek. So that seems to work against all of the literary theories. Another example of that kind of problem, yes? I don't believe it does. No, I don't believe this construction occurs in Acts. Not positive about that, but in any case, you can't understand. Well, it may occur in the very early parts of Acts where Luke is still dependent on some kind of source, but in the later material in Acts where Luke is doing his own narrative, never occurs. Anyway, another problem here, which is similar to that, is the use of the term Son of Man. Now, of course, when you read the Gospels, it doesn't take too long before you realize that when Jesus uses the title Son of Man, he's referring to himself. And the Gospel writers recognize this. And the strange thing, if there is literary dependence, then it's strange that well, let me put it, how to put it this way. Sometimes, each of the Gospels will sometimes have the title Son of Man, where another Gospel, Jesus will simply say, I. Okay? So, for example, Matthew may have Son of Man. Matthew has the Son of Man in chapter 16, verse 13. Mark and Luke, at that spot, have I. So does that mean that Matthew, if Matthew is using Mark and Mark has I, that Matthew uses the Son of Man because he wants to use that title for when Jesus says I? Well, that's an interesting theory, but the difficulty is that there's occasions where Mark and Luke have Son of Man, but Matthew has I. So sometimes Matthew will have I, and Mark and Luke will have Son of Man. So you can't say that Matthew just likes the title Son of Man, because then that would mean here he changed Son of Man to I. So what's going on? How do you explain that? Furthermore, Luke has Son of Man in places where Matthew has I. Luke alone has Son of Man where Matthew has I. So the point is, of all this data, is that if Matthew is using Mark, or if Mark is using Matthew, why would he in one place change I to Son of Man, and in another place change Son of Man to I? That doesn't seem to make any sense. And yet, on every literary dependence theory, this has to take place. That would mean that whoever's using whomever, they are changing sometimes I to Son of Man and sometimes changing Son of Man to I. Why would they do that? That doesn't seem to support any theory, and it goes against. All right, well, those are some objections to all of the literary dependence theories, which brings me back to some form of an oral gospel solution. Now, as I said when we started this whole business, generally speaking, if I see an exam where somebody has words that correspond very closely to somebody else's words, I begin to suspect literary dependence. And because of that, that way of thinking, generally speaking, very little attention has been paid accretions. And so Bultmann had argued that what's going on in the Gospels is what corresponds to what Ken Bailey called informal, uncontrolled oral tradition. And probably most Western scholars have fallen into this category that the oral tradition that did take place in the early church was of this informal, uncontrolled. There's just all kinds of development taking place, rapid changes, like that little game that you played as teenagers, gossip, where you would start something and send it down a line, and by the time it got to the end, the story was entirely different. That is the viewpoint that resulted in an assumption that there must be literary dependence because of the very, very close correspondence, not only in wording but in order. Gerhardsen's view was that it was more like rabbinic, that it was formal and controlled. That is, that it had to be memorized exactly, everything had to be memorized, and that it had to be memorized according to a very precise pattern. So the rabbinic mode, as it were, is Gerhardsen's view. Ken Bailey's view is that it's informal, uncontrolled. There are certain elements which cannot be changed. The basic outline of the story, the setting, the environment, that is the who said what to whom, those things cannot be changed. But details can be added, and they can also be eliminated. Precise wording can be changed, except for the thing that climaxes the story. That has to stay the same, but many things can change. Well, Bailey points out that this corresponds exactly to what we have in the Gospels. Gerhardsen wanted to say this is exactly, or the rabbinic is exactly what we have, but actually that doesn't correspond to the data very well, because there's too many modifications that have taken place to say that it is very formally controlled. And yet Bailey's viewpoint fits perfectly. And furthermore, as you'll see when you read the article, Bailey demonstrates how what gets precisely remembered corresponds to what gets precisely remembered in these oral cultures that he was dealing with, and how it corresponds to what we have in the Gospels. For example, the sayings of Jesus. The sayings of Jesus had very formative, high important status in the church. And so it's the sayings of Jesus that it's most likely to be remembered precisely and be exactly the same in all three Gospels. So corresponds very well. Furthermore, Bailey has done his work within a context of cultural awareness. He's very much aware that the New Testament is an entirely different culture than our Western culture. The Bedouin culture amongst whom he was working is very close to the New Testament culture. And so it's very much more likely, it seems to me, that what happened in terms of oral transmission would correspond to a culture that is very similar than to our Western culture, which is quite different. All of these source critical theories, the theories of literary dependence, all of them developed in the 19th and 20th centuries, all of them developed in the West, in Western culture, and all of them operated on assumptions of textual development such as we have in modern Western culture. And it seems to me that Bailey's work is more likely to be accurate. Now, there are some difficulties. First of all, there is still the problem of the high verbal correspondence in Greek rather than in Aramaic. The highest verbal correspondence, as I said, is the words of Christ, which are the words most likely to be memorized and guarded. But why is it that in Greek they are exactly the same? Well, my suggestion is that possibly it's because the gospel, when it went to the Gentiles, which is fairly early on in the history of the church, was early on translated. Now, in Acts chapter 10, Peter goes to Cornelius, who's obviously a Greek-speaking person. That means Peter has to preach in Greek. What does he do when he's telling Cornelius what Jesus said? Well, he has to translate it. Now, my suggestion is that the translated form, because it became largely a Gentile mission for the church as it expanded, took on a precise form very early in the history of the church. And so when Paul or Barnabas or Saul, Apollos or any of the preachers were telling the story of Jesus and telling the story of what he said and teaching the content of what Jesus said. When they were going around the Greek world, by the time that was happening, which would have been in the 50s, the words of Jesus were already translated and were remembered in precisely that translated form. Now again, I can't prove this. This has no probative value, but it does have explanatory value. It's also interesting that there's a remarkable correspondence in connected order. Bailey also pointed out that the order of events was remembered. It could be slightly altered, some things could be altered, but basic order or outline was remembered, and we already pointed out where in Acts 10, there's an order that basically corresponds to what we have in the Gospels. And finally, just point out that ultimately it's impossible to decide whether the sources were written or oral. We really don't know. And so when I'm talking about the oral tradition, I'm talking about it primarily as saying this has as much explanatory value, if not more, than any of the written theories, written source theories. However, I can't be dogmatic because there's just too many unprovable things for every viewpoint. William Farmer pointed out that Judaism in the first century was Torah-centric. Torah, law, was deemed to deal with and determine all of life, and therefore all of life had to be understood in terms of Torah. And this is why the rabbis had a pride of place. The rabbis were the Torah experts. That made them life experts. The interpretation of the Torah was transmitted orally, even though there was an enormous quantity of it. The embryo of this Torah centrism or traditionalism is to be found in the covenant concept itself. Christianity inherited this way of thinking. The new revelation in Christ was a new covenant tradition. Although the application to life could develop, just as the application of Torah developed, the content of the covenant was fixed. A Jewish rabbi might embellish the application of something in the Torah to his heart's content, but he would not lay a finger on the fixed tradition, even on the previous oral tradition. That was fixed. There was addition, not modification, of the original tradition. Rijke, in his book on the roots of the synoptic tradition, said that whatever the case regarding the literary development of the Gospels, it seems clear that oral tradition existed not just as sayings or isolated pericopes, but as whole Gospel tellings. All of those things suggest, again, that there's an environment, whether or not there's written sources, there's an environment which really tends to a remembrance of an oral tradition. So whether or not there's a literary development in the Gospels, my point is this, that undoubtedly the oral tradition surrounding Jesus hardened at a very early stage, and that means that the Gospel material has a very close relationship with the actual historical events themselves, and that it was remembered accurately. And so we can have confidence that whatever the story of the sources, all of the Gospels have laid hold of this very, very carefully remembered material and is historically reliable. No matter what view one takes of things, things do happen very quickly. In Old Testament studies, they talk about tradition criticism and traditional development, but they're not talking about a couple dozen years. They're talking about a couple of centuries or several centuries. And literary theories don't talk about 30 or 40 years. They talk about 30 or 40 decades. So the rapid development of the Synoptic Gospels, again, shows a very close connection with original material. And it's likely that the whole Aramaic oral, the whole Greek oral or the Aramaic or Greek literary processes had to occur within at most about a 70-year period. It used to be thought that the Gospels were written in the second century. Now, hardly anybody dates the Gospels later than about 85 or 90. And that's partly because of textual evidence, partly because of evidence from early church fathers. But see, even if it's 80 or 90 that the Gospels were written, that's still within 60 years of the death of Jesus. So you're very close in time. People are still alive and can check on those materials. There's just not enough for development of a folk legend mythology. There's just not enough time. Furthermore, in terms of the rapid solidification, Ken Bailey again points out that that the oral tradition actually can harden within 2 or 3 days, not just years, but within 2 or 3 days, people are remembering a story or are telling a story in a very standardized form within a couple of days of the event. My conclusions are these. Not only the wording of the pericopes, that's the individual stories, especially the sayings of Jesus, but also the so-called Markan framework of the narrative history was standardized extremely early in the oral tradition. That's what I think can be concluded. The so-called Markan framework and the wording of the pericopes got standardized very early on. Maybe not in 2 or 3 days, but certainly within 2 or 3 years. I would even prefer to call the Markan framework the Petrine framework. The reason being that Papias, remember, mentions that Mark was Peter's interpreter in Rome. And that after Peter departed, Mark wrote down the stuff that Peter had taught, but not in order, Papias says. Now, that may be after the death of Peter. It might be that after Peter departed Jerusalem. It's hard to tell what Papias means there. But in any case, there's this tradition that Mark preserves, the Petrine, the teaching of Peter. Peter was one of the inner circle, and therefore this all makes sense, if that's the case. It may have originally been in Aramaic, but it quickly became standardized in Greek because that's the language that was being used to teach the gospel to most people. Now, I'd even point out that there's a tiny little bit of evidence for this. I say it's a hypothesis, but there's a tiny little bit of direct evidence for this. In Mark chapter 1, verse 41, we're told that Jesus was moved with compassion. And the word in Greek is splanchnistes. He was moved with compassion. I guess it's a participle, splanchnistes. Okay. And being moved with compassion, he spoke to the crowds. He spoke parables. This is chapter 1. That's right. Although the reason I'm mentioning this, that he was moved with compassion, is that there are a few manuscripts, Western manuscripts, such as Bedzai, that's Codex D, and a few Latin manuscripts, have orgisthes. He became angry. Now, in the context, becoming angry doesn't seem to fit very well. When he sees somebody having illness, you can see him having compassion. When he sees somebody having an illness, he gets angry. Well, you could still possibly explain it in that you could say, well, he got angry that Satan was having such power in the world. But Satan isn't really in view in the it's not mentioned specifically in view in the passage, although he, you know, he lies behind things. But still, it seems odd that he have orgisthes here. But now here's the oddity. The Talmud refers to the fact that Jews who lived in Galilee had a particular kind of accent, and that this accent, this Galilean accent, did not differentiate between an ayin and a hey in the way they pronounced things. Probably like a hey or an h. And that would allow for a Galilean who's speaking to use a particular word ra'am and have it and use the term raham and have it confused with ra'am, because in the Galilean accent they would sound the same. Perhaps the Western tradition then, this tradition of manuscripts, was confused because of Peter's preaching in Rome, and that possibly what happened was that an earlier form of Mark something, when they heard Peter preaching, Peter said it in Aramaic, and John Mark translated it, but when Peter said he had compassion, Raham, the translator thought he said Ra'am to get angry, and so that got into the tradition. Well, this may be stretching things a little bit, but it's possible, and it would certainly fit the external data, the testimony from the early church fathers, and the actual situation of the gospel itself. Dr. Lane, William Lane, in his commentary, has pointed out that the likelihood is that the Gospel of Mark was written to people in Rome. There are many points at which certain peculiarities of Mark fit the Roman church's situation. For example, the fact that Mark mentions when Jesus is out being tempted in the wilderness that he was with the wild beasts, the Theria. And Lane suggests that may have meant a lot to the people in Rome who were possibly facing wild beasts. But any case, and then there's the Latinisms in Mark as well. So it all fits together, and maybe this is a Petrine framework. And that explains why Mark appears to be the earliest gospel, or the closest to the original tradition, because Mark reflects this preaching of Peter, which became standardized fairly early on and became orally a source for the other gospels as well. It is virtually impossible to tell which gospel was first, because each gospel then, on this view, may have been redacted independently of the others. I say may have been. It's also impossible to tell what the original framework was, although it probably can be argued that Mark best preserves that framework. Differences with Matthew or Luke are more likely to be Matthean or Lucan alterations than Markan alterations of what we have in Matthew and Luke. But it is risky to put too much weight on Markan priority. Mark, at some points, can reflect a later development. The gospel writers may have shared certain sources, written or oral, with which they elaborated the basic account. Mark probably uses less of this material than Matthew or Luke, but that does not necessarily mean that it is earlier. Luke, in his opening lines in chapter 1, refers to the fact that he consulted with autoptoi, that is, people who actually themselves saw things, and huperetai, that is, servants of the word. They may refer to eyewitnesses who could recite the standardized history. That was their job, and that's where Luke's material came from. The interpretation of the Gospels, which is what we're about, should not be based on a comparison with a hypothetical original Gospel or original sources, because there is no way, certainly, to reconstruct. So all of this effort that's going into reconstructing Q, or the effort that has gone in previous generations into reconstructing Ur Marcus, the original form of Mark, it's all hypothetical, and it doesn't really help us in our task of interpretation. Theodor Zahn, at the end of the 19th century, pointed out already, how is it possible to understand an author when he gets interrupted after every third word by somebody suggesting a source? How can one writing be compared with another when each one is not known by itself as its author intended, and consequently not understood in its details? It's certainly legitimate to compare one gospel writer with another, but that's not in order to arrive at some previous form which transcends them both, but rather to enable us to see the particular contribution of each of the gospel writers. It's only after the internal integrity of the gospel, of each gospel, is considered in its own right that we can examine their relationships. And so my conclusion from all this simply is, we can't really know, but maybe God deliberately made it so confusing so that we wouldn't place much stock in reconstructed sources. Rather, God has given us four Gospels, and these are the materials that we need to work with in understanding what God is trying to teach us and what Jesus taught us. So with all that in as the background, basically, I'm saying source criticism can be helpful in helping us see the distinctiveness of each of the Gospel writers. But that's what we're really interested in, is what does Matthew say? What does Mark say? What does Luke say? Not what does Urmarcus say, or what does Q say? So these are the documents that we need to focus on, not on some hypothetical antecedent documents.